Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am covering in this audio 1 Samuel chapter 23, the entire chapter, verses 1 through 29. We'll see David saving the city of Keilah in this chapter. Our context is this. David has begun or is in the middle of his long run from Saul. Saul tried to kill David in chapter 19. Jonathan warns David in chapter 20. You need to get out of town. In chapter 21, David goes up right to Nob, right northeast of the Mount of Olives, where the tabernacle was, where Ahimelech the priest was, and Ahimelech gives him some bread, and David leaves because of Doeg the Edomite being there, who was going to go tell Saul. And then David leaves from Nob. He goes to the cave of Adullam, which is over there in the west in Philistine territory in chapter 22. And now that sets the stage for this chapter, chapter 23. Verses 1 and 2, it was reported to David, "Look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and raiding the threshing floors." So David inquired of the Lord, "Should I launch an attack against these Philistines?" The Lord answered David, "Launch an attack against the Philistines and rescue Keilah." Now this is amazing. David is worried about the enemies of Israel even as he's trying to run for his life from Saul, and he only has 400 men with him. Well, who reported to David that the Philistines were fighting against Keilah? Well, maybe the men of Keilah sent to David. David is now, by the way, at the forest of Hereth, which is near Adullam. If you look at the map, Keilah is right down the road, maybe 2 or 3 miles south of Adullam. So he's in the neighborhood. It could have been the men of Keilah, but it could have been unnamed people who were acquainted with what was happening at Keilah. But anyway, David finds out the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and raiding the threshing floors. Well, this is what Philistines did. It was an ancient custom. Not only the Philistines, but the Midianites in the time of Gideon. Recall, the Israelites would work and work and harvest and get their wheat all ready for threshing on the threshing floor, and the Philistines would say, "Whoa, perfect timing. Let's go in and get the wheat. It's already cut. It's already grown. We don't have to work. We can just steal it." Now, if you look at the map, BibleAtlas.org, we see Keilah is due south of Adullam, where David spent some time in a cave up there hiding from Saul. And David is right south of Adullam in the forest of Hereth. And he decides, he looks down there, hears about the Philistines coming after Keilah, and says, "Shall I fight them?" He inquires of the Lord. That would mean either he asked Abiathar, his high priest, who would use the Urim and Thummim, that means of divine divination kept in the breastplate of the supposed to be the high priest, or it could be the prophet Gad was with David now. Gad has already showed up at Adullam in the last chapter, chapter 22, verse 5, and Gad tells David, "Don't stay in the stronghold." That actually was in Mizpah of Moab, actually, not in Adullam. "Go into the land of Judah, leave Moab, go back into the land of Judah." And so David went into the forest of Hereth, where he is now. So it was either Gad or it was the Urim and Thummim, but he is now going to ask of God. And now he is contemplating attacking the enemy of his enemy, Saul. Well, usually the enemy of your enemy is your friend. So you would think the Philistines would be David's friend because they're attacking Saul's territory. But no, David is still concerned more about the interest of Israel than he is about his personal situation. Now, why did David even inquire of the Lord should he attack? Well, he could doubt that he should attack because he's now not acting under the official orders of Saul. Also, he has such a small number of men, only 400. Those are two good reasons right there. He's a renegade. He's leading a renegade band of soldiers, guerrillas, if you will, and there weren't a lot of them. So there would be good reasons why he needed to ask God, "Should I attack?" We go down to 1 Samuel 23, verses 3 through 5. "But David's men said to him, 'Behold, we are afraid here in Judah, there in the forest of Hereth. How much more than if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines?' Then David inquired of the Lord once more. And the Lord answered him and said, 'Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand.' So David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines, and he led away their livestock and struck them with a great slaughter. Thus David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah." Now, David's men said, "We're afraid where we are now here in Judah in the forest of Hereth." Now, they were afraid even though they were hiding in the forest. They had a place of sanctuary. They were hiding in a place where they could easily receive reinforcements if people wanted to join their band to fight against Saul. But if they left the forest and went south to attack the Philistines at Keilah and defend the city there, they would have to fight the Philistines to the south and then expose themselves to Saul coming down from Gibeah from the north. And they could have been squinched in a pincer movement, not a pincer movement, but a they could be enveloped. And so, yeah, they were afraid. So David, in verse 4, inquires of the Lord once more, either through Gad or through Abiathar, the high priest in the Urim and Thummim. He asks the Lord again. Now, Gill and Clark say he was not asking for David's sake, for his own sake, because he already knew what the will of God was. But he asked for the sake of his men who were doubting. That could be. In which case, David is a smart guy, a good leader. He wants his people to be confident when they attack. So David attacks, beats the Philistines, leads away their livestock. Now, that's probably helpful for a band on the run. A lot of steak, hamburger, available for the renegades. And those cattle were probably stolen from the Israelites, as Adam Clark says, and David's just getting them back. So David delivers Keilah. We go to verse 6. Now, it came about when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah. Remember, Ahimelech was the priest at Nob who got killed along with all of his 85 male relatives, along with the women and children, as Doeg the Edomite, at the behest of Saul, went up there and murdered everybody. There was only one priest who escaped, and that was Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech. And Abiathar flees to David, and he came down with an ephod in his hand. Of course, the ephod is a symbol of priesthood at that time. It's only supposed to be the high priest that wears it. Abiathar was the high priest, so I guess it was okay. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says about an ephod. Quote, the ephod, similar to a vest, was a part of the priestly apparel and served as the receptacle for the divine objects that were cast by lot, called Urim and Thummim. Carefully phrased questions were posed. The Lord then controlled the lot to provide yes or no answers. That's why I like to think of the Urim and Thummim as a black stone and a white stone. You ask it a yes or no question. Should we attack Keilah? Well, we drew a white stone out. That means, yes, God controlled that. And so, yes, we're going to attack Keilah. That kind of thing. The scripture that describes the ephod and the Urim and the Thummim is in Exodus 28:28-30, which I will not read to you. We go now to verses 7 through 10. When it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah, Saul said, God has delivered him into my hand, for he shut himself in by entering a city with double gates and bars. So Saul summoned all the people for war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. Now David knew that Saul was plotting evil against him, so he said to Abiathar the priest, bring the ephod here. Then David said, O Lord God of Israel, your servant has heard for certain that Saul is seeking to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. David told Abiathar to bring the ephod there because the ephod had the Urim and Thummim, and he needed to ask God some more questions, which we'll see in verse 11. Will the men of Keilah surrender me into Saul's hand? That's what he's worried about. Now, you would think that the citizens of Keilah would be very grateful to David because David had wiped out the Philistines there, gotten their grain back. Philistines couldn't steal it from the threshing floor anymore. But instead of being grateful, they try to turn David over to Saul. That hasn't happened yet. Saul's going to come down and ask, and then he's planning to come down and ask for David, and Keilah would have surrendered them over to Saul if David had stayed. It doesn't say they actually turned him over to Saul. It just says it was told Saul. Somehow the word got out, and it wasn't necessarily people of Keilah that told him, but somehow the word got out, and Keilah would have turned David over to Saul if God had not told David to get out of Dodge. So these people were somewhat ungrateful. Now, the reason they did this, of course, is they're scared to stand up for a man that only has 400 soldiers and Saul has the whole army of Israel. They were scared of him. So, I mean, I'm a little bit sympathetic, but still, that's very ungrateful. So in verse 8, Saul summons all the people for war. That would be all the people of the surrounding districts. He mustered them up and he goes for war. Now, he could be going against the war against the Philistines, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, which was the public reason for mustering the troops. But the real reason was going to be to get David. It might have been a little impolitic for him to say, come on, come fight the war. We're going to go get David. He's a rebel. He's a traitor, because the people love David. So he might have just said, we're going to go get the Philistines, but he's really going down there to get David. And I suspect that's the truth. Now, this ephod that Abiathar had brought to David, Abiathar probably put the ephod on, as Gil said, and then used the Urim and Thummim. Adam Clark suggests that David put the ephod on. Now, David's not a priest. Abiathar is. Abiathar's the remaining high priest that's available. All the others haven't been killed. So I think it was Abiathar that wore the ephod. We go to 1 Samuel 23:11-13. David asked of the Urim and Thummim. Well, more directly he does. He's ultimately asking the Lord God of Israel, as in verse 10. So he's asking God, will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? Will Saul come down just as your servant has heard? Come down from Gibeah, down to Keilah. O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant. And the Lord said, he will come down. Then David said, will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul? Again, these are yes, no questions. And the Lord said, David probably drew the white rock, they will surrender you. Then David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah, and they went wherever they could go. When it was told Saul that David escaped from Keilah, he gave up the pursuit. That doesn't mean he gave up the pursuit of David absolutely and went back to Gibeah. He gave up the pursuit of David at Keilah. We'll see that in a minute. Now, we might ask, whoa, wait a minute. We have the Urim and Thummim saying that the people of Keilah will surrender David to Saul, but that didn't happen. Well, obviously, the prophecy was based on a contingency that didn't happen. David didn't stay there. The contingency is implied, and this would be the contingency. If you stay here, David, that's the contingency. If you stay here, Saul will come down. That's understood. No prophecy is meant to destroy free agency. The prophecy should not be read like this. Saul will come down, and there's not a thing you can do about it, so you might as well stay here in Keilah and get captured. Well, of course not. It was understood. If you stay here, you're going to get caught. Now, notice now in verse 13, David fled with 600 men from Keilah. He only had 200 when he was in the cave of Adullam. He's picked up 200 people. So people like David, he's a leader. Of course, the people that were with him were debtors and disgruntled people. I forgot the word that was used in the Holman Christian Study Bible. They were unhappy. And so he's getting the outlaw types, but he's got 200 more of them now. Here's what the NASB says about the original 400. David departed from there, means from Nob, and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. So he had family members with him too. Everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt. So in distress, why? For committing a crime and being chased by kinsmen redeemers. Everyone who's in debt. Oh, if I get caught by my creditor, I might be a slave. Everyone who is discontented, maybe with the government, maybe just because they're grumpy types. Anyway, 400 men. That was at Adullam, and now he's got 600 men at Keilah, and he leaves. 1 Samuel 23, verse 14. David stayed in the wilderness in the strongholds and remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver David into his, Saul's, hand. Now again, when it says Saul gave up the chase in verse 13, that doesn't mean he completely quit. It means that Saul quit chasing David at Keilah, and so now Keilah goes to the wilderness of Ziph. Now, where is that? Well, if you look at the map, BibleAtlas.org, if you go 10 miles southeast of Keilah, you cross the road that goes from Beersheba to Jerusalem, and Hebron is on that road. So you cross Hebron on the way, and you go down to Ziph, which is on a steep mountain range there. And David remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph, which means the wilderness around that town of Ziph. So they're hiding out in the caves there around Ziph. If you go another 15 miles, well, let's follow the roads. If you go about 4 miles south on the road between Hebron and Ziph, that's not the main road, it's another road. And then if you go south from Ziph about 4 miles, you end up at a place called Carmel. And if you take a left there and go due east and go about 15 miles, you come to En Gedi, which is the big city on the west coast of the Dead Sea, about halfway from the north and the south tips of the Dead Sea. Famous place. Actually, I've been by there. I was by there I didn't actually go to En Gedi. If I remember, the tour guide said it was too far to get to, if I remember correctly. But we were at the road in the desert there. And I asked the tour guide, I said, how do people go to school here? No, that's not what I asked him. I saw a McDonald's. I said, what in the world is a McDonald's doing near En Gedi? And he said, because for the school kids. I said, well, there's nothing but desert around here. I mean, what school kids go to school around here? And he said, oh, yeah, they do. So they put a McDonald's in for the kids to eat them McDonald's. At any rate, this is where David is running around in the wilderness now around Ziph. Saul sought him every day, verse 14 says. So you see, he's still looking for him. But God did not deliver David into Saul's hand. Now that Saul did not find David was in God's providence, of course, his providential control of circumstances, because Saul could easily have found him. I say easily. I don't know how bad The wilderness is there. He's looking in the wilderness, and there's only 600 men. They could hide in caves. But still, they could have found him, and God prevented that. We go now to verse 15, 1 Samuel 23. Now David became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. Well, I think David already knew that Saul was after him, but I think what it means is that he's hiding in the wilderness around Ziph, and he gets new word that Saul is on his trail. Now, David was at Horesh, which is not right at Ziph. It's in the wilderness of Ziph. If you look at Ziph and go down a road about three miles to the southwest from Ziph, you end up at a place called Horesh with no question mark, so they seem to have identified it. The NIV Study Bible has it on the southeast with a question mark. So maybe there is some dispute. But anyway, somewhere in the wilderness of Ziph, David is at Horesh, and he finds out that Saul is about to get him. So we go down to 1 Samuel 23, verses 16 through 18. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. Ah, oh, there's nothing like good encouragement when you're in trouble. Thus he, Jonathan, said to David, "Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows that also." So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. Now we need to remember this Horesh. A lot of people don't know about Horesh. We need to remember it. Some important stuff happened here. First of all, in verse 17, Jonathan tells David that the house of Saul is finished. Now remember, Jonathan is the crown prince. He's the heir apparent in the house of Saul. When Saul dies, he's going to be king. But he tells David, "Nope, you're going to be king." And what he's saying there is, when my father dies, whenever that might be, you're going to be king, not me. And he doesn't seem to care. Now, was he acting treasonously? Adam Clark asked. Well, here's some reasons one might think so. Well, here's some reasons that one might think that he was not acting treasonously. Jonathan knew David had always acted in the interest of Israel and not himself. Jonathan knew that Saul was acting evilly. Remember, Saul had tried to throw a spear at David three times and actually threw a spear at Jonathan once. He knew Saul was trying to kill David. Jonathan knew that God, through Samuel, had appointed David to be king. Neither Jonathan nor David had taken one step to humanly hasten the providential hand of God in getting rid of Saul prematurely. They hadn't done a thing like that. In fact, we're going to see later on in En Gedi, David has a chance to kill Saul and doesn't do it. Touch not God's anointed. Jonathan had saved his father from becoming a murderer by several times interfering with Saul's plans to kill David, for example, when at the new moon feast when David didn't show up and Jonathan shot his arrows past the servant and said, "The arrows are far away, go get them," and David, hiding at the rock there, hears and he takes off. So, no, Jonathan was not a traitor. He's just stating facts. He knows that King Saul's going to die, and he's basically, I think, even though Saul has a lot of power over David right now militarily, I think Jonathan is counting on what Samuel had prophesied, because Jonathan was a godly man. How did Jonathan know that David was going to take over? It could have been a special revelation of God, but I don't think so. I think Jonathan had already discovered that David had been anointed by Samuel. How did he discover that? Well, Samuel could have told him, or David could have told him. Somebody told him, I'm sure. And then he says, "When you're king, I will be next to you." And that's very humble for an heir to the crown to take second place. Let's read what Jameson Fawcett Brown say about Jonathan here. Quote, "What a victory over natural feelings and lower considerations must the faith of Jonathan have won before he could seek such an interview and give utterance to such sentiments." Remember now, Jonathan has left Gibeah, gone all the way down to Horesh, while his father is looking for David to kill him. And if Jonathan had been found out, he could have been accused of treason. But he goes all the way down there to encourage his covenant friend David. Jameson Fawcett Brown continued to talk with calm and assured confidence of himself and family being superseded by the man who was his friend, by the bonds of a holy and solemn covenant, could only have been done by one who, superior to all views of worldly policy, looked at the course of things in the spirit and through the principles of that theocracy which acknowledged God as the only and supreme sovereign of Israel. Neither history nor fiction depicts the movements of a friendship purer, nobler, and more self-denying than Jonathan's. Great rhetoric there. So yeah, Jonathan was a good guy. His father was an SOB. Now Jonathan says in verse 17 that his father Saul knew David was to be king. Well, how did Saul know that David was going to be king? Well, Samuel maybe had told Saul that Samuel had anointed David to be king when he went down to Jesse's house. That's a reasonable speculation, but here's an outright verse that says this. 1 Samuel 15:28, so Samuel said to Saul, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. And I think Saul's smart enough to figure out who the neighbor was. It's David. He didn't name him by name, Samuel didn't, but he did say your neighbor, and that's probably David. Saul would have figured that out. So that's why Jonathan said Saul knew. He did know. When Samuel said that the kingdom had been given to your neighbor, Saul, that was when Samuel was in disgust. Samuel, in disgust, left Gilgal when Saul had not killed Agag the Amalekite like he was supposed to, and Saul grabbed Samuel's cloak, trying to get him to come back to Gilgal to give him some cred before the people who weren't going to be happy, and he tore Samuel's cloak, and Samuel looked at that cloak and said, nope, the kingdom's going to be torn away from you, Samuel, given to your neighbor. So, yeah, Saul knew, but even though he knew, he's still chasing David. That reminds me of the devil. The devil knows he's going to be wound up at the end and thrown into the lake of fire. He's not stupid, but he's still carrying out his nature and trying to destroy as many people as he can before he goes there, which just shows how evil he is. You know you're going to lose, but you're going to take as many people down with you as you can. Verse 18, at Horesh, we're talking about here in verse 18, so the two of them, David and Jonathan, made a covenant before the Lord. This is a renewal of a covenant they already had. Now, three times David and Jonathan made a covenant. I'm just going to assume it's the same covenant, renewed twice. 1 Samuel 18:3, this is sometime after David had killed Goliath. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as much as himself. 1 Samuel 20:16, this is when David was with Jonathan at Gibeah before Saul's new moon feast where David didn't show up. 1 Samuel 20:16, then Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord hold David's enemies accountable. And here, right here at Horesh in 1 Samuel 23, I'll read it again. Then the two of them made a covenant in the Lord's presence. Now, why did they renew the covenant again? The NIV Study Bible says they renewed the covenant again because Jonathan wanted to make a formal ceding of the kingdom to David. They wanted to make it official. Kingdom's yours now, David. I'm finished with Saul. This is according to the NIV Study Bible. I think that's probably right. They made this covenant before the Lord in verse 18. I take it is before the Lord because God's looking down from heaven is before the Lord. But that phrase in the Old Testament, a lot of times before the Lord means before the high priest. In this case, it would be before Abiathar, who would have the Urim and Thummim in his hand or in hand. At any rate, after the covenant happened, Jonathan goes back to his house, which is still in Gibeah, I assume, way up there to the north, or the north of Jerusalem. And Jonathan and David probably never saw each other again after this. At least it's not recorded in the scripture. We go down to 1 Samuel 23, verses 19 through 20. Then Ziphites came up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, is David not hiding with us in the strongholds at Horesh on the hill of Hakalah, which is on the south of Jeshimon? Now then, O king, come down according to all the desire of your soul to do so, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand. Well, while David was at Horesh, Saul didn't find him, and apparently he had given up and gone back home to Gibeah. And then, after Saul was gone back home, these Ziphites, remember, Ziph was the place that David had, or the wilderness of Ziph was the place that David had fled from Keilah after killing the Philistines at Keilah. The Ziphites got scared of David being in the vicinity. They thought, oh my goodness, we might be looked on as traitors if Saul finds out about this. So they went back and tried to betray David, said, he's all around us. Now, you would have think that the Ziphites, since they were from the same tribe as David, the tribe of Judah, they might have been more sympathetic to David. But they were probably terrified after the priest was slaughtered at Nob. And they might have thought that Saul is one mean dude. He's a bloodthirsty tyrant. He might come after us. I can understand that. Now, the people of Ziph, they're sitting on top of a hill. They could look out. Remember, David is hiding in the wilderness around there. Let's look at the map again. If you go about 3 or 4 miles southwest of Ziph, you get to Horesh. If you go about 5 miles to the east of Ziph, you get to Hakalah. So Horesh and Hakalah, the two H places, that's basically in the wilderness around Ziph. Surrounding Ziph, and the people in Ziph got nervous about that, and so they betrayed David to Saul. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this, quote, from the tell, the hill of Ziph, a panorama of the whole surrounding district is to be seen. No wonder, then, that the Ziphites saw David and his men passing to and fro in the mountains of the wilderness. Spying him at a distance when he ventured to show himself on the hill of Hakalah, they went in haste to Saul to tell him of the lurking place of his enemy. Now, on the hill of Hakalah is where David wrote Psalm 54. The heading of Psalm 54 says this, "For the choir director on stringed instruments, a maskil of David, when the Ziphites came and said to Saul, is not David hiding himself among us?" That's the verse we just read. So this is what David was thinking here as he's at Hakalah in the wilderness of Ziph. Psalm 54, verses 1 through 7. "God, save me by your name and vindicate me by your might. God, hear my prayer. Listen to the words of my mouth. For strangers rise up against me, and violent men seek my life. They have no regard for God, Selah. God is my helper. The Lord is the sustainer of my life. He will repay my adversaries for their evil. Because of your faithfulness, annihilate them." Ooh, an imprecatory psalm. "I will sacrifice a freewill offering to you. I will praise your name, Yahweh, because it is good. For he, Yahweh, has delivered me from every trouble, and my eye has looked down on my enemies." Remember, David's up on a hill, on a stronghold, and he says, "My eye has looked down on my enemies." He's looking around, seeing Saul's armies coming, but they're not going to get him. And he says, annihilate them. Well, that's actually what happened to Saul and the army. They got wiped out at Gilboa. A little while later, we'll see when we get there. So David's imprecatory prayer was answered. Actually, I love imprecatory prayers. There's so many Christians that read those things and say, oh, this is embarrassing. How could a loving God do this? Listen, David was a military man. He was the anointed king of Israel. He was being chased by a murderous SOB who had already murdered all the priests of God. No, he needed to be annihilated, Saul did. I don't have any sympathy for Saul. What is the matter with people in today's wussy-puss culture that can't see that evil needs to be judged? I don't feel sorry for Adolf Hitler, quite frankly. I don't feel sorry for Pol Pot. I don't feel sorry for Xi Jinping or Mao Zedong. And I sure don't feel sorry for Saul. Now, there's another place mentioned in this verse. Verse 19, the Ziphites tell Saul, is David not hiding on the hill of Hakalah, which is on the south of Jeshimon? Well, that Jeshimon is not on the map, and it means the waste place. In fact, the Bible in Basic English and the New American Bible translated as the wasteland. And that makes sense to me because all this area around here, I'm sure, looks like kind of like low hills. But there's no towns nearby. There's no roads. It's just a mess. It's wilderness, wasteland. Easton says Jeshimon means the waste. Probably some high wasteland to the south of the Dead Sea. Well, that's not where we are now, the south of the Dead Sea. But Easton says, rather, not a proper name at all, but simply the waste or wilderness, the district on which the plateau of Ziph looks down. And that makes sense to me. It's just the wasteland around Hakalah. That's all it means. I don't know why all the translations insisted on keeping the Hebrew there, Jeshimon, which doesn't mean anything to me or you. We go now to 1 Samuel verses chapter 23, verses 21 through 25. "May you be blessed by the Lord," replied Saul. The "you" refers there to the Ziphites. "May you Ziphites be blessed by the Lord," replied Saul, "for you have taken pity on me. Go and check again, investigate, and watch carefully where he goes and who has seen him there. They tell me he is extremely cunning. Look and find out all the places where he hides. Then come back to me with accurate information, and I'll go with you. If it turns out he really is in the region, I'll search for him among all the clans of Judah." So they went to Ziph ahead of Saul, the "they" meaning the Ziphites. They went back to Ziph ahead of Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness near Maon in the Arabah south of Jeshimon, and Saul and his men went to look for him. When David was told about it, he went down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. Saul heard of this and pursued David there. Now, in verse 21, Saul tells the Ziphites, he's in Gibeah now, "You have taken pity on me," as if the murdering SOB needed compassion, needed pity, Saul. He actually sounds like he's feeling sorry for himself. So he tells the Ziphites, "Go back down to your town, Ziph, and look, remember Horesh to Halakah, Horesh to the southwest and Halakah to the east. That's the area in which David was hiding in the caves and the hills there." Saul tells the people of Ziph to find out where the caves are, find out where his hiding places are, so I can go down there and get him. Saul says in verse 23, "If it turns out he really is down there around the wilderness of Ziph, I'll search for him among all the clans of Judah." That word clans is translated thousands in the NASB. It means the families. Micah 5:2 says, "But as for you, Bethlehem, too little to be among the clans of Judah." That shows that the tribe of Judah is divided into families or a clan. And a clan was roughly 1,000 people, as John Gill says. Now, David and his men were in the wilderness near Maon, so we need to look at the map. If we look at Ziph here, remember with Horesh to the southwest and east of Ziph was Halakah. Ziph's in the middle. Well, if you're at Ziph, and if you go straight down the road, you'll hit Carmel. And if you take a left at Carmel, you go to En Gedi, about 10 miles, 15 miles or so. But then if you instead stay on the road going south from Carmel, about 1 mile, you'll hit Maon. Now, Maon is not too famous, but it's actually had some interesting stuff happen there. And by the way, it's the wilderness of Maon. It doesn't mean he was staying in town, staying in the wilderness around Maon. But Maon is an interesting place. The name means habitation, according to Easton's. It was a town of the tribe of Judah about 7 miles south of Hebron. Yeah, that was the road I said coming down. If the road going from Ziph to, you come down straight from Ziph to Maon is about 5 miles or so. Well, if you're at Ziph and go up the same road, which bends to the northwest, you'll end up in Hebron. So that's the area where we are. It's interesting because this is where the story of Nabal, fool, and Abigail, the future wife of David, takes place, right there in Maon. Only some small foundations of hewn stone, a square enclosure, and several cisterns are now to be seen at Maon. Are they the remains of Nabal's great establishment? Well, Easton's is talking like a tour guide now. Who knows, but it's kind of interesting. They stayed at, quote, the rock at Maon. That's probably a cave in the rock. I don't know why it's called the rock. Young's and Green's literal translation, as well as the NIV, have the rock, so apparently it's a well-known rock. Later on in verse 28, they're going to call that place the Rock of Escape. I suspect it's the same rock, the Rock of Escape from Maon. So now we go to 1 Samuel, and of course they're staying not perched on top of the rock. They're staying in a cave that's in the rock to hide from Saul. 1 Samuel 23, verses 26 through 29. Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. This is at Maon. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize them. But a messenger came to Saul, saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land." So Saul returned from pursuing David and went to meet the Philistines. Therefore they call that place the Rock of Escape, capital R, capital E, Rock of Escape. David went up from there and stayed in the strongholds of En Gedi. So in verse 26, we see David putting a mountain, the mountain there at Maon, between himself, his troops, and Saul. And Saul was trying to surround David by dividing his troops. Doesn't say they were dividing his troops, but that's what it means. How else is he going to surround David? He surrounds his troops. He sends part of his troops one way around the mountain and sends part of his troops the other way around the mountain, and David is behind that mountain. So David, once again, is in deep doo-doo. Now, Adam Clark says Saul was ignorant of David being on the other side of the mountain. I don't think so. I think he knew what he was doing. He had intelligence from the Ziphites. But by the providence of God, right in the middle of the entrapment of David, a messenger comes to Saul and says, "Hey, the Philistines have made a raid back on the land, somewhere back around Gibeah, I presume, or south of Jerusalem, wherever, back on the border between Philistia and Israel." It doesn't say where. In fact, the Philistines may have taken advantage of Saul's absence to make such a raid. Once again, this is the providence of God at work. So Saul leaves. David and his bands wipe their brow with a sigh of relief. And then they name the rock there the Rock of Escape. The NIV footnote has it also could be called the Rock of Parting, depending on how you translate it. And then David leaves Maon. He goes back up the road a mile to Carmel, and then takes a right and goes on the road that runs straight from Carmel to En Gedi. Now, that's assuming, well, Saul's gone now, so he doesn't have to hide anymore, so I assume he took the road and went to En Gedi. Now, En Gedi's a famous place, too. I've already mentioned being not at it, but close to it on my tour of the Negev down there. But let's read what Easton says about En Gedi. It's a famous place. It means Fountain of the Kid, En Gedi does. It's a place in the wilderness of Judah on the western shore of the Dead Sea, nearly equidistant from both extremities. It's in the middle on the west, from the north side tip to the southern tip of the Dead Sea. To the wilderness near this town, David fled for fear of Saul. We just read that. It was at first called Hazazon Tamar in Genesis 14:7. It was a city of the Amorites. The vineyards of En-Gedi were celebrated in Solomon's time in the Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 4. The fountain from which it derives its name, Fountain of the Kid, that fountain rises on the mountainside about 600 feet above the sea, and in its rapid descent spreads luxuriance all around it. And that's what's so strange. Right there in the middle of the desert, you have all this green stuff. Along its banks of this wadi, or this fountain, the osier grows abundantly. I don't know what an osier is. That shrub is thus described by Porter. The stem is stout, measuring sometimes nearly a foot in diameter, and the plant grows to the height of 15 feet or more. It has a grayish bark and long oval leaves, which, when broken off, discharge a milky fluid. The fruit resembles an apple and hangs in clusters of two or three. When ripe, it is of a rich yellow color, but on being pressed, it explodes like a puffball. It is chiefly filled with air. This is the so-called apple of Sodom. Interesting if you're into horticulture. Another one of my commentators, whose name I unfortunately forgot to write down, says that En-Gedi is, quote, celebrated for its vineyards, in the Song of Solomon again, chapter 1. It was also celebrated for its balm. It is reported to be a mountainous territory filled with caverns and consequently proper for David in his present circumstances. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that En-Gedi is the spring of the wild goats or gazelles. A little bit more elegant translation than Fountain of the Kid. But anyway, it's a place worth remembering. And with that, we are finished with chapter 23 and ready to go on to chapter 24. In our next audio, verses 1 through 22, we will see David sparing Saul's life at En-Gedi. Hope to see you then, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.